When the phone rang in the middle of that hot July night in 1961, 13-year-old Frank Drum couldn't have known it would mark the beginning of a summer that would forever alter his life. Set against the backdrop of small-town Minnesota, Ordinary Grace has captivated readers since its publication, earning the Edgar Award for Best Novel and becoming a New York Times bestseller. William Kent Kruger's masterpiece resonates with readers for its authentic portrayal of loss, faith, and the complicated journey toward understanding. Stephen King praised it as a novel that transforms the ordinary into something extraordinary, while the book has found fans among celebrities like Reese Witherspoon, who included it in her book club selections. What makes this coming-of-age story so powerful is not just its mystery elements, but its profound exploration of how grace appears in the most unexpected moments of our lives. Death arrived in New Bremen, Minnesota, during the sweltering summer of 1961, beginning with Bobby Cole, a sweet boy with thick glasses who died on the railroad tracks. For 13-year-old Frank Drum, this would be the first in a series of deaths that summer, some by accident, some by nature, some by suicide, and some by murder. Frank lived in the flats, the poorer part of town, with his Methodist minister father Nathan, his ambitious writer mother Ruth, his musically gifted older sister Ariel, and his younger brother Jake, who struggled with a stutter. Their household also included Gus, a troubled war veteran who lived in the church basement and assisted Frank's father. The night after Bobby Cole's death, Frank and Jake accompanied their father to the jail to collect a drunken Gus. There they encountered Morris Endall, a high school dropout with a bad reputation who had gotten into a fight with Gus at Rosie's bar. When Endall mocked Jake's stutter, calling him retard, Nathan calmly but firmly defended his son. As they were leaving, the officers mentioned something odd about Bobby Cole's death, that he seemed to have just sat on the tracks as the train approached. Later, as Frank watched his father tend to the drunken Gus in the church basement, Gus muttered something puzzling about Nathan being responsible for deaths. Before dawn, Frank spotted his sister Ariel sneaking home through the lilac bushes, while his father remained in the sanctuary, praying for everyone but himself. An early glimpse into the complicated dynamics of the Drum family that would unravel throughout the summer. The first funeral of that fateful summer was Bobby Cole's, where Frank's mother sang Swing Low, Sweet Chariot with a voice so beautiful it made Frank believe Bobby was truly being carried home. His father delivered a sermon that was earnest but not passionate. Then Gus, despite having been drinking, approached the coffin and spoke movingly about how Bobby had helped him in the cemetery and how the boy had held happiness in his hand easy as if he just plucked a blade of grass. Despite their father's strict rules against it, Frank and Jake often walked along the railroad tracks. Days after Bobby's funeral, they were doing just that when they discovered an Indian man examining a seemingly sleeping man beneath the trestle. Dead, the Indian told them, inviting them down to see. Despite Jake's protests, Frank scrambled down the embankment, his curiosity overwhelming his caution. The Indian, who they would later learn was Warren Redstone, showed them the dead itinerant he called Skipper, explaining he'd just fallen over while they were talking. As Redstone searched the dead man's pockets, he found a photograph of a woman with a baby. Frank read the inscription, October 23, 1944, Johnny's first birthday. We miss you and hope you can be home for Christmas. Mary. When Redstone placed his hand on Jake's leg, Frank suddenly realized their danger and yanked his brother away. They raced to Halderson's drugstore, where they reported finding a body, though Jake, without stuttering for once, simply said, a dead man. At the police station, Frank didn't mention Redstone, maintaining Jake's lie. Their father grounded them to the yard for a week, but shared something personal. The first dead man he'd seen outside a coffin was a young German soldier during the war. A soldier who'd seen a lot of battle stopped and said to me, you'll get used to it, son. He was wrong, boys. I never got used to it. Later, Frank accompanied his father to the burial of the itinerant. At the cemetery, Sheriff Gregor, Gus, and Mr. Vanderwall helped carry the simple pine coffin to the grave. Nathan read the 23rd Psalm and spoke comforting words about how even this unknown man was known to God and would no longer feel alone. Frank thought it strange but fitting that such a kingly resting place had been given to a man about whom they knew so little. As summer progressed, Frank and Jake encountered Warren Redstone again. During one encounter, Frank noticed that Redstone possessed Bobby Cole's glasses. Later, while exploring Redstone's lean-to by the river, Frank discovered a hidden tin can containing various items, including Bobby's glasses, a Purple Heart medal, and the photograph from the dead itinerant. This discovery planted seeds of suspicion about Redstone that would grow throughout the summer. The summer revealed to Frank how complex adult lives could be. His father served three Methodist congregations, requiring their family to attend all Sunday services. His mother directed the choir with pride and harbored dreams of becoming a famous author like Ayn Rand, taking correspondence courses from a New York City writer's school. Their marriage showed signs of strain. His father's dedication to his congregations often kept him away from home in the evenings, while his mother responded coolly to his gentle reminders about church obligations. Frank and his family visited the Clements home outside Cadbury, where Travis ran a small engine repair business from a converted barn. Mrs. Clement, who sang in the choir, greeted them through the screen door, not inviting them in, and speaking so quietly Frank could barely hear. When her son Peter appeared, Frank noticed he had a black eye. Later, in the car ride home, his parents discussed the situation. His mother was upset that the choir ladies had lied about Mrs. Clement being sick rather than admitting she was hiding bruises. His father explained that Travis had been a POW in Korea and still had nightmares, drinking to cope with his trauma. "Every man handles in a different way the damage war did to him," he said. Another glimpse into adult complexity came when Frank and Jake eavesdropped on a marital counseling session between the Sweeneys. Edna complained about Avis's lack of sexual interest after his workday, while Avis felt pressured. Frank's father compassionately helped them recall their love story before referring them to a specialist. Though fascinated by this adult world, Jake later expressed guilt about their eavesdropping. The most mysterious adults in New Bremen were Emil and Lise Brandt. Emil was a renowned piano virtuoso and composer who had once proposed to Frank's mother before leaving for New York. He'd befriended Aaron Copland and found success in Hollywood, composing film scores and socializing with celebrities before the war interrupted his career. After returning from war blind and disfigured, Emil lived in isolation with his deaf sister Lise in a renovated farmhouse. Frank's sister Ariel spent time there typing Emil's memoir, while Jake formed a special friendship with Lise, helping in her magnificent garden. Their friendship seemed preternatural, two people who couldn't communicate easily with the rest of the world finding understanding in each other. The title Ordinary Grace comes from a quote by Aeschylus that Frank's father references. "He who learns must suffer, and even in our sleep, pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, and in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom to us by the awful grace of God." This idea of wisdom coming through suffering permeates the entire narrative. When Emil Brandt attempted suicide by swallowing sleeping pills, it was Jake who helped save him. Lise had frantically appeared at their door while everyone was at church. Understanding her distress despite her inability to speak, Jake fetched Gus, who called the fire department. After Emil was taken to the hospital, Jake became something of a celebrity at church, though Frank's exaggerated retelling of his heroism frustrated Jake to the point where he shouted, "Bullshit, goddammit," on the church steps. Later, Emil confided to Nathan that he doesn't have the courage to try again, but refused to explain what weighed so heavily on him that made his music seem insignificant. When Nathan offered to pray for Emil, he dismissed it as about as useful as throwing a penny down a wishing well. The 4th of July celebrations brought momentary joy to New Bremen. Ariel performed in a chorale production of The Freedom Road, conducted by Ruth and accompanied by Emil Brandt on piano. The piece traced America's history through conflicts and celebrated its pioneers, receiving thunderous applause. Ariel took her bow in a beautiful red dress adorned with heirloom jewelry, though Emile refused to join her center stage. But the celebration turned to tragedy when Ariel didn't come home that night. The next morning, Frank woke to find his parents in the kitchen with Sheriff Gregor, Deputy Hauptmann, and Carl Brandt, Ariel's boyfriend. They were piecing together her disappearance. She was last seen at a bonfire party by the river where everyone had been drinking. Carl admitted he left around 2:30 a.m. without her, assuming she'd gotten another ride home. The search for Ariel consumed the town like a fever, transforming the usually quiet community into a hive of worried activity. Frank and Jake joined their father at Sibley Park, where the remnants of teenage revelry painted a disturbing picture. Empty beer cans scattered like fallen leaves, broken bottles glinting in the grass, and a smoldering fire that still sent wisps of smoke into the morning air. Frank felt certain they'd find something, a scrap of clothing, a shoe, any trace of his sister. But initially, the scene yielded nothing but evidence of typical teenage recklessness. The investigation shifted dramatically when Officer Goyle recovered Ariel's distinctive gold heart-shaped locket with mother-of-pearl insets from Warren Redstone's possession. The locket, a cherished 13th birthday gift from their parents, had never left Ariel's neck. Redstone, disheveled and defensive, claimed he simply found it caught in branches upriver and vehemently denied any involvement in her disappearance. When Frank and Jake encountered him near his makeshift lean-to by the river, Redstone's eyes went wild at the sound of approaching police sirens, and he bolted into the underbrush. Frank made the momentous decision not to call out or alert anyone about seeing him escape, a choice that would haunt his dreams and burden his conscience for years to come. Despite an extensive search along the railroad tracks and surrounding woods, authorities never located Warren Redstone. They meticulously combed through the O'Keefe's basement where he had been staying, but found nothing definitively connecting him to Ariel's disappearance. Life in the Drum household entered a strange limbo of desperate hope punctuated by waves of terrible anticipation. Nathan spent hours on his knees in prayer, while Ruth cycled between bewildered silence and explosive outbursts of rage. Neighbors and church members maintained a steady procession to their door, bringing casseroles, bread, and coffee cake, their offerings of comfort seeming simultaneously essential and utterly inadequate. The awful truth revealed itself on a deceptively ordinary afternoon when Frank and Jake were racing driftwood boats downstream to the trestle. Frank's eye caught something red trapped in the debris beneath them, a splash of color that shouldn't have been there. His world contracted to a single point as he recognized Ariel's dress and her distinctive copper-colored hair moving gently in the current. With trembling voice, he sent Jake running for their father, while he remained rooted in place, paralyzed with grief above his sister's body. The discovery shattered what remaining normalcy the Drum household had maintained. Ruth retreated into near catatonic silence, spending days sitting in darkened rooms, refusing meals and visitors alike. Nathan transformed into someone Frank barely recognized. His normally robust father became a pale ghost of himself, moving through the house with stiff, mechanical movements and an emotional distance that seemed unbridgeable. Jake's response manifested as rage, particularly directed at God, refusing to pray or even bow his head during grace before meals. When Frank finally confronted him about his anger, Jake's response sent chills down his spine. Somebody did kill Ariel. The words forcing Frank to confront a possibility he had desperately tried to deny, preferring to believe her death was a tragic accident rather than face the darker alternative that someone in their community was capable of such evil. The coroner's findings devastated the New Bremen community, shattering any lingering hope that Ariel's death had been accidental. She had been violently struck unconscious and deliberately thrown into the river. The coroner's findings devastated the New Bremen community, shattering any lingering hope that Ariel's death had been accidental. She had been violently struck unconscious and deliberately thrown into the river. The discovery that she had been 5 to 6 weeks pregnant added another layer of tragedy and complexity to an already haunting case. Suspicion immediately centered on Carl Brandt, given their public argument and apparent relationship, but the truth proved far more complicated. In an emotionally charged confession to Nathan, Carl revealed the carefully guarded truth about his identity. He had never been intimate with Ariel. Through tears and trembling words, he disclosed his homosexuality, a secret he had hidden beneath a carefully constructed facade of heterosexual relationships. Their heated argument, witnessed by so many, had actually centered on Ariel's pregnancy. Carl had urged her to visit a doctor in Minneapolis who could perform a discreet abortion, but Ariel had steadfastly refused, determined to keep her baby and raise it in New Bremen regardless of the social consequences. The revelation of Carl's sexuality rippled through the conservative small town like a shockwave. Unable to face the scrutiny and judgment, Carl's life ended tragically when his sports car slammed into a massive cottonwood tree at high speed. The investigation never definitively concluded whether alcohol or intentional suicide claimed his life, leaving another painful question mark hanging over the community. As summer deepened and the tragedies multiplied, Frank developed a disturbing theory that shifted suspicion to an unlikely suspect, Emil Brandt. He suggested that Emil had killed Ariel to conceal that she was carrying his child. When Jake logically questioned how a blind man could have committed such a crime, Frank demonstrated, with unnerving precision, how easily Emil could have navigated the familiar path to the river even without sight, having walked it countless times before losing his vision. Nathan, ever the voice of reason, insisted on hearing Emil's side before passing judgment. Their confrontation proved emotionally wrenching. Emil vehemently denied killing Ariel, explaining that he had loved her in his wounded way, a complex affection shaped by his war trauma and blindness. He acknowledged that Ariel had visited his property at night, but maintained she only stood in the yard, watching his window like a silent guardian. Nathan found himself believing Emil's raw emotional testimony, but declared their long friendship irreparably broken. The investigation's final devastating turn came when Frank discovered Ariel's missing possessions, her cherished gold watch and distinctive mother-of-pearl barrette hidden in Lise Brandt's shed. Jake admitted he had harbored suspicions about Lise, who had always regarded Ariel with barely concealed hostility and possessed the physical strength necessary for the crime. When Frank confronted her with the damning evidence and threatened to reveal everything to Emil, Lisa's composure shattered. She attacked Frank with a crowbar in desperate fury. Jake's intervention likely saved Frank's life, though it put him directly in harm's way. As Lise stood poised to strike Jake with the crowbar, something, perhaps a final flicker of humanity or the horror of what she had become, stayed her hand. She collapsed in a heap of remorse and confession, her whispered apologies revealing the terrible weight of her actions. After Ariel's funeral, the Drum family struggled to find their way forward through a fog of grief and uncertainty. Ruth had left Nathan temporarily, a separation that had shaken the entire family, but returned home the night of the funeral, drawn back by the gravitational pull of shared loss. During the reception in the church fellowship hall, mourners gathered around tables laden with casseroles and consolation, when Nathan, true to his calling as a minister, prepared to say grace. Ruth, her voice raw with emotion, interrupted him. "For God's sake, Nathan, can't you, just this once, offer an ordinary grace?" Her words carried years of accumulated frustration with his formal, ministerial approach to faith. In the painful silence that followed, a silence that seemed to stretch like a taut wire across the room, Jake unexpectedly volunteered. Despite his lifelong struggle with stuttering, which had often rendered him silent in public gatherings, he delivered a flawless prayer. "Heavenly Father, for the blessings of this food and these friends and our families, we thank you. In Jesus' name, amen." This simple grace, spoken without pretense or theological flourish, transformed Ruth's face from anguish to wonder. Nathan stood mystified, perhaps seeing for the first time how profound simplicity could be. Frank took it as a divine sign their family would survive, a moment of ordinary grace that felt like a shaft of sunlight breaking through storm clouds. The family's journey continued beyond that pivotal moment. The Drum family eventually moved to St. Paul, where Nathan accepted a pastor position at a larger congregation, seeking both professional growth and, perhaps, a fresh start away from the shadows of New Bremen. Lise Brandt spent her remaining years in Minnesota Security Hospital after confessing to killing Ariel in a moment she claimed not to remember. A tragedy within a tragedy, as two families were effectively destroyed by one act of violence. Gus, who had been such a steady presence during that fateful summer, married Ginger French, the horse ranch owner who had shown such kindness to the boys. Their later death in a plane crash added another layer of loss to Frank's story. Every Memorial Day, Frank, Jake, and their father make a pilgrimage to New Bremen Cemetery, a ritual of remembrance that has become sacred over the decades. As Frank's father, now over 80, has grown thin and fragile, their visits have taken on new meaning. They methodically visit the graves of all those connected to that transformative summer. Bobby Cole, whose death first introduced the boys to mortality. The nameless itinerant who died alone. Carl Brandt, whose quiet dignity never wavered. Morris Endall, whose troubled life ended in violence. Emil and Lise Brandt, whose family tragedy mirrored their own, their grandparents, and Ginger and Gus, whose lives touched theirs so briefly, yet profoundly. Their final stop is always where Ariel and Frank's mother lie, beneath a spreading linden tree, a spot where his father will someday join them, completing a circle of love and loss. The tree's leaves whisper overhead, as if carrying messages between the living and the dead. Frank often recalls Warren Redstone's words from years later. They're never far from us, you know, the dead, no more in a breath. Through ordinary grace, those simple, everyday moments of forgiveness, understanding, and love, the Drum family found their way through extraordinary tragedy. Frank learned that wisdom indeed comes through suffering, but also that grace appears in the most unexpected places. Like a stuttering boy offering a perfect prayer when his family needed it most, or in the quiet ritual of annual remembrance beneath a linden tree. Looking back from adulthood, Frank realizes how that summer transformed him from an innocent child into someone who understood the complexities and contradictions of the adult world. He witnessed how people could be simultaneously good and bad, how secrets could destroy lives, and how forgiveness could begin healing even the deepest wounds. Jake's journey is particularly poignant. His stutter made him an outsider, yet gave him a unique sensitivity to others who were different or struggling. His friendship with the deaf Lise Brandt demonstrated his ability to connect beyond words. When he confessed to Frank, "I feel like a freak sometimes," after learning about Carl's homosexuality, he revealed his own deep insecurities. Yet it was Jake who ultimately provided the ordinary grace that began his family's healing. The novel explores how childhood trauma shapes adult lives. Frank's father had been forever changed by his wartime experiences, carrying invisible wounds that affected his ministry and family relationships. Travis Clement's war trauma manifested in violence toward his family. Emil Brandt returned from war physically and emotionally scarred. Warren Redstone carried the burden of his people's historical trauma. Even Morris Engdahl's cruelty stemmed from his own troubled background. Yet ordinary grace ultimately suggests that while trauma shapes us, it need not define us. Frank's father tells him, "The dead are never far from us," but this becomes not just a statement about grief, but about how we carry those we've lost within us, allowing their memories to guide and comfort us rather than haunt us. The novel's final wisdom is that grace, both extraordinary and ordinary, appears not despite suffering, but often through it. As Frank's father quotes from Aeschylus, "Wisdom comes by the awful grace of God." The ordinary graces, a brother's perfect prayer, a father's unwavering faith, a mother's return home, a community's support, prove more powerful than the extraordinary tragedies of that summer in New Bremen.